So it's a pleasure to be here in this nice program, and I'm going to talk to you today about something which can justfully be thought of as application of Casimir forces and fluctuation forces, namely the effect of zero modes in non-trivial backgrounds in quantum field theory, yeah? Which you have to sum on up over, like in the classical Casimir problem. So, to get oriented, let's think of a simple, very simple case. Let's think about, say, a two-dimensional scalar field theory with a potential which has minima, and this potential can support, this field theory can support solitons. In two dimensions, there is no problem to support solitons made entirely of scalar fields. So typically, the soliton, which is a classical solution of the equation of motion with finite action or with finite energy, will be very heavy. It will be inversely proportional to the coupling constant, so the weak coupling constant. Therefore, it's highly non-perturbative. Now, so you have this massive object sitting somewhere, say in its rest frame. And now we want to quantize the field theory around that background. So what you do, you look for the fluctuations, second order fluctuations, quadratic fluctuations. You find the spectrum. And in order to compute the leading correction, you have to sum over all zero-point energies of the modes and subtract from it the zero modes of the vacuum. And then you get the first order correction, I mean the first leading quantum correction, the one-loop correction. I want to discuss something which is a bit more complicated, a model which is purely, originally, I mean, at least when defined, is purely fermionic, and that's the Gross-Neve model. So what is the Gross-Neve model? So imagine in two dimensions again, I mean Minkowski. Imagine that you have a Dirac particles described by these Dirac fields. But it's not enough to have one, so we have n of them. Okay? And they are governed by this action. It's possibly an explicit mass. It's this four Fermi interaction. Okay? With this four Fermi interaction. Now, when the four Fermi coupling is zero, you just have n Dirac fermions, and the symmetry and the model probably obviously has the UN symmetry. I can rotate among the n Dirac fermions using unitary matrices, and nothing will change. The four Fermi interaction makes this model very non-trivial and interesting. And this was originally introduced in 1974 by David Gross and André Neve. I understand that André Neve's son is now a postdoc here working on biophysics. So, and the reason they introduced it was in order to study in more detail features of asymptotic freedom and dimensional transmutation in a non-trivial field theory, because this model mimics the behavior of QCD. It is a two-dimensional problem, a two-dimensional model without gauge fields, but it's a nice model in the sense that it has the features of the gauge theory, of the non-abelian gauge theory, the features which I just mentioned. Now, in addition, as is usual, when you have asymptotic freedom, you have confinement, you have chiral symmetry breaking, and this model contains all these features, and you can study, since it's exactly solvable, you can study them in detail. Now, this is a very good model because it also has uses beyond what it was invented for. And as it turned out, about 10 years later, less than 10 years later, this model reappeared in solid state physics, in condensed matter physics, when people studied conducting polymers. This is the Schrieffer figure model for conducting polyacetylene. Polyacetylene is a one-dimensional polymer which can conduct, which acts like a metal in some sense. So Schrieffer, Higger, and Su explained the conductivity of polyacetylene in a theory which, in the continuum limit, boils down to this model, but with, of course, n equals 2, because this, the n is just the spin state of the electron. And of course, Schrieffer also was related to this place. He used to be here. And Higger also. McDermott and Shirakawa received the chemistry Nobel Prize in 2000 for explaining the behavior of these conducting polymers. So, of course, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to focus on the field theoretic aspects. But it's a very interesting. Just mentioned it because it's a very interesting model to look at. So, this model, as I will show, as I will explain, bears solitons. The solitons arise after you compute the effective potential. I mean, you integrate. I will show you how to introduce quantum corrections to the potential, to the effective potential in this field theory. And once you have the effective potential, you in that effective potential, you can see that there should be solitons. Remarkably, we can analyze them and solve them, find their shape, and find the spectrum of excitations in their background explicitly and exactly. Okay. I should mention that here, in this case, actually the obvious symmetry which one could guess or see, UN is actually only a partial symmetry of the model. The model actually has a much bigger symmetry, and this is the symmetry O to N. And this can be exposed when you write each Dirac fermion in terms of its two Majorana, namely real. This is complex, you know. When you write it in terms of its real and imaginary parts, in terms of spinors. Okay, so these are two Majorana. And when you use a particularly convenient representation of the gamma matrices, ID slash is, of course, I d mu, gamma mu. When you use the appropriate representation for gamma matrices, you can see that it breaks into a O to N symmetry in much the same way that when you have this bilinear complex complex expression, you can write it as a O to N, which is UN invariant. You can write it as a O to N invariant combination. This is essentially the same thing. Now, another general remark before I get into more details is that for n equals 1, if you don't have the explicit mass, without the explicit mass here, for n equals 1, this is just the Turing model. The Turing model is conformally invariant. It doesn't have a mass cap. It's what condensed matter people use to describe the Luttinger liquid. But for n greater or equal to 2, there is a mass gap. And all these features that I mentioned, asymptotic freedom and chiral symmetry breaking and dimensional transmutation, arise. I will discuss today the large N limit. However, I should hasten to add that the model is actually exactly solvable for any n, in the sense that you can obtain its S matrix, non-trivial S matrix, based on elementary properties. The S matrix should satisfy analyticity, causality, crossing symmetry, and all these classical things. And all scattering processes in this model, when I'm talking about the case when the explicit mass is zero, and all scattering processes never produce particles. There is no particle production, and all scattering processes can always factor into 2x2 scatterings. Okay. So I should also mention that there is a generalization of this where you can add another term. This produces a scalar, while this produces what we call a pseudo-scalar, a quantity which flips its sign under reflection. And this system, when you have this additional term, is indeed only UN symmetric. It doesn't have the O2N symmetric. But it is also interesting on its own right. It's called the chiral Gros-Neve model, or the two-dimensional Nambu-Yonah-Lazinio model. And it is a kind of a relativistic version of superconductivity, it's a relativistic model which behaves like a superconductor, like the BCS system. It is also exactly solvable when you don't have this mass, but I'm going to focus, since we don't have enough we don't have much time today, I'm going to focus only on this model. Maybe I should also only mention that when you write the Dirac equation for this model, you obtain something which is very similar to the Bogoliubov-Degen equation for the order parameter in a superconductor. And since this model is exactly solvable, you can learn some things about superconductivity. Okay, so let's go back to the original Gros-Neve model. And a convenient way to write it is to disentangle the four Fermi interaction by introducing an auxiliary or Hubbard-Stratanovich field. So sigma is a scalar field, depends on space and time. but it doesn't have kinetic energy, doesn't have derivatives. And I suppressed here the index, the flavor index. A is the flavor index, the unitary group. Okay? Yeah, the most important thing. Thank you. I will also use a convenient representation for gamma matrices, as I mentioned, in which the gamma matrices are purely imaginary. So this is the so-called Majorana representation. When you write down the Dirac equation, with or without an explicit mass, doesn't matter, it doesn't matter, and you look for stationary states, since gamma matrices are purely imaginary, this is real. So therefore, if this is a solution, its complex conjugate is also a solution. So you see that the spectrum of states come in pair. They are paired if omega is not zero, but there is possibility of having a zero mode, which doesn't have to be paired. The fact that bound states come in pairs is a reflection of charge conjugation invariance. Okay. So now, let's write the effective action for this model. So we have this generating functional, or vacuum-to-vacuum amplitude. Since the fermions are Gaussian in this representation, I can integrate them over. And since it's a complex fermion, I'll get the determinant to the power n because there are n flavors. So and if I want to have an explicit mass, I can actually, oh, sorry, I should have written it like this. Sigma squared minus 2m. Okay. Minus sigma. I should have written it like this originally. This is the correct form. Okay. So if I have an explicit mass, there should be an additional term here. So now, in order to take the large n limit, you see that the first two terms have to match. The two terms have to match, and therefore 1 over g squared has to be as large as n. So this is the large n limit, semi-classical limit. N is playing the role of 1 over h-bar here. Okay, so our instinct in this case is to look for, I mean, the first instinct to look for the ground state. What is the ground state? This is a Poincaré invariant theory, so vacuum should be translational invariant. So we look for saddle points where sigma is constant. Okay? So what does it mean? It means that we have to look for, as I said, for saddle points of this functional written here in terms of constant sigma. And once you do that without any too many details, since sigma is constant, obviously the effective action on a constant will be proportional to n. L is the spatial box, T is the temporal box, times some function of sigma, and the renormalization scale. I'm renormalizing, and I already write the renormalized expression, and you find the following. Where mu is the sliding renormalization scale. On the way, I had a cutoff. I absorbed it in the behavior of the Berg quantity, of the Berg couplings, and everything is now expressed in terms of renormalized quantities. Lambda is the running coupling. And n mu is the running mass. And this is, of course, a physical quantity. It should be a renormalization group invariant. Therefore, by equating it, its values at two different mu's, we can see what the parameter want to do in order to maintain renormalization. So when you do that, you see that when you look at two scales, mu1 and mu2, you see that the coupling has to run in this way. While the ratio has to be an invariant. This you get by comparing coefficients of sigma square, and this you get by comparing coefficients of sigma. This relation tells you that the theory is asymptotically free, because you see that if you want to make, if you want to go to very high scale, this has to get smaller. Yeah? Okay. So notice that the quantum corrections, you have a 1 over pi times a log. This is a hallmark of a loop, one loop. This is the one loop correction, and the quantum effects introduce this log into the effective potential. So we started. Let's look at the say M capital M, the explicit bare mass zero. Then you started with this potential for sigma, just sigma square. So before quantum corrections, you have this. Once you have taken quantum corrections into, so you think that sigma equals to zero is the minimum, but it's not. Once quantum corrections are taken into account, you see that this is unstable, and the system has two minima. When capital M is zero, they are degenerate. Okay, so I'm of course drawing P of sigma. And these are the ground states of the theory. So there is a gap. Sigma, I remind you, we started. It's written here. So when sigma acquires expectation value, it acts like a mass for the fermions. So there is a gap opening in the spectrum of fermions. And in the condensed matter parlance, this is the Pyrrhus instability. When you get to go to the one-dimensional lattice or to the polyacetylene, you fill it into half filling, then it becomes unstable to dimerization of location of atoms. Phonon fields, sigma is the phonon field, introduces instabilities, there is a dimerization into a bipartite structure.
Usually you already have mass in the beginning.
No, I said for mass, for M, capital M is zero, equals to zero.
Okay.
Now okay? So this is like the easing model without external field. Okay? Now if you turn this on, you will prefer one of the vacuum, and you can draw it here. You see you have a linear term, so it breaks the parity. So when you have capital M, you'll break parity, and therefore you'll have only one preferable minimum, a single ground state. So for capital M 0, you have an enhanced symmetry, Z2 symmetry. Here it's the discrete chiral symmetry. So it's psi goes to gamma 5 psi and sigma goes to minus sigma. That's when M equals to 0. That's the symmetry of the original Lagrangian. It's a discrete version of chiral symmetry, which is broken spontaneously. It's discrete, so there's no problem breaking it into dimensions. Okay. So the system will choose one of these minima and break it. While if M is not zero, then you don't have this symmetry and you have only a single vacuum. Okay. All this is well known. I'm not telling you anything new. But I need to tell you this because I needed to draw the potential, the form of the potential. So let's look at the potential, effective potential. Okay, in this case, in the symmetric case, you have two degenerate minima, and therefore, in addition to small excitations of the fermions near each of the vacuum, you obviously have the possibility of making a kink, starting in one side of the world here and ending on the other side here, or a bound state of kink anti-kink, or an anti-kink. So you have all sorts of excitations. These are the solitons I'm talking about. Here you have only one possibility, namely you start here, you wander around, and you have to come back because you have only one minimum in order to have a soliton with finite mass, namely finite energy. So how on earth am I going to find the shape of this soliton? And moreover, how am I going to compute its mass? That's the problem. So the problem, to give you a flavor of this, the complexity of the problem, just consider the saddle point equation. Okay, essentially, when you look at the action. When you look at the action here, you see that the saddle point equation looks like something like this. Delta S in the Lagrangian limit, the solitons in the Lagrangian limit, the solitons should be solutions of this equation. Generally, we should look for time-dependent solution. This is a very hard problem. Why? Because it looks like this. This equation looks like this. So you have to solve equation self-consistently where the potential or the scalar potential of the mass term in the space-time dependent mass in the Dirac equation equals the diagonal resolvent. So it's a functional equation. So how can you solve it? That's the source of difficulty. Of course, this difficulty arises in many problems in physics. So there are a few possibilities. One possibility is to marry this equation, this awkwardly looking equation, with identities that the resolvent has to satisfy. This can be done when there is no time dependence. When there is no time dependence, the diagonal resolvent of the Dirac equation, which in this case is actually the diagonal resolvent of Schrödinger equation, which is the square of the Dirac equation, satisfies identities known as the Gelfand-Dicke identity. The diagonal resolvent of a Schrödinger operator has to satisfy an identity. It comes from its definition, never mind how to derive it right now. It's an identity. It comes from definition of the Green's function. And in this case, for the, at least for the Gross-Nevers model and also for the Kyrle-Gross-Nevers model, for the Gross-Nevers model and also for the Kyrle-Gross-Nevers model, it's possible to find the static solution. Derivative is respect to x. Sorry. So this is is fixed. You're at a fixed energy, so okay. The reason is that R is just the equation has two independent solutions. The Schrödinger equation has two independent solutions, second order. And Rxe is simply the product of these solutions divided by the Wronskian of these solutions. And from this, it follows. It's short proof, but I don't have time to discuss this. I just want to mention that in the case of the Gross-Nevers and also in the case of the Kyrle-Gross-Nevers, when the background fields are static, it's possible to marry this and this into a happy family and solve and find the backgrounds. The backgrounds that one finds are very special, not only because they are solutions of this awkward-looking equation, but also because they are so-called reflectionless. Namely, if you look at the Schrödinger equation in the background of these potentials, these Schrödinger potentials don't reflect. They move everything that hits upon them, but with a phase shift. Okay? So this can be very useful practically if you design an optic fiber. If you design it in this way, then you minimize losses. But these reflectionless quantities, the reflectionless potentials, are very important in the theory of solitons, and they keep up appearing in various occasions. For example, in the KdV equation, they are very important in finding solitons in the KdV equation. So, very recently, a guy in Ecole Normale, Zarembo, Konstantin Zarembo, used this method to solve the so-called giant magnons in some problems string theorists are interested in. So, essentially, he was solving a self-consistent equation for space-dependent condensate in the linear sigma model, ON linear sigma model, which is also a problem I worked on long ago. With respect to the Kyrle-Gross-Nevers model, Tony Z and I, many years ago, used this method to find solitons, those chiral solitons. And afterwards, Mike Stone and Tony Leggett used a similar this method to find the shape of the profile of a order parameter in a clean superconductor in a self-consistent way, something which appeared in FizRev B about 10 years ago. Okay. So how much time do I have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, my God. Okay.
You're supposed to ask him, is that poetic 5 minutes or real 5 minutes?
In which reference of frame? I can start become poetic. Okay, so let me just... I can wrap it up in about 5 to 10 minutes with you. You stalled me for about a few minutes. Okay. So this is one method, using the resolvent. I'm not going to... I don't want to talk about it today. What I want to talk about is a method associated with the so-called inverse scattering theory, which enables you to solve these solitons. Actually, it was the method originally used in 75 by Dashan, Haslacher, and Neve to study such solitons. Dashan, Haslacher, and Neve studied the M equals zero case, because when M is not zero, there is a difficulty which they didn't deal in with the method. And they were able to prove rigorously that the saddle points are reflectionless. So let me just explain to you how this comes about. Reflectionless means that when you do a scattering experiment or solve a scattering problem, your wave packet goes through without any reflections. Everything goes through, but with phase shifts, of course.
It's like a Markman potential.
A what?
Like a Markman potential.
That's a special example. So, okay. When we I'm going to limit myself to the static case. The time-dependent case was also treated by Dashan, Haslacher, and Neve, and they were able to guess a solution. They found a breeder solution, a soliton which breeds. But the time-dependent case is not, I mean, there is no algorithm, there is no method. They just were clever enough to guess it. It would be interesting to understand why their method works and to apply it elsewhere. So sigma of x static. In this case, in this case, everything boils down to Schrödinger, the theory, spectral theory of Schrödinger operators instead of Dirac operator, for the following reason. You use this simple identity of gamma matrices to express the trace log which appears in the effective action as the square root. As the half the trace log . Okay. Now when you square this you get essentially a Schrödinger operator. Why? Uh, because in this case, of course, there is no time. When the time derivative hits sigma, it gives you zero. And if you use the sigma matrices, the gamma matrices, which I introduced earlier, you find that this becomes a 2x2 diagonal matrix with two Schrödinger operators. These two Schrödinger operators are very nice. They are isospectral, up to a zero mode. You can map the spectrum of one of them to the other in a non-singular way. And since they are isospectral, you can express everything in terms of H minus. And then all that is left is so you have to be able to calculate the trace log of a Schrödinger operator. This can be done using scattering methods. I mean, this is what you do in Casimir effect calculations every day. And in addition, I remind you that in the effective potential there is also a term like this. Okay? Integrated over X. Now, integral of sigma is in effect integral over dx is in effect integral over sigma minus sigma prime. If I discuss the non-topological soliton, namely the king anti-king bound state, since it goes back to the original value at plus and minus infinity, integral over sigma square is integral over sigma prime. But this is the integral over the Schrödinger potential. It also can be expressed in terms of phase shifts and things like that.
Did you find sigma prime?
Sigma, d sigma by dx. It's the derivative. Sigma of, I should have defined. I said that sigma is static, so it depends only on x, not on t. Okay, sorry. And So all the pieces are here. So you have the integral over the Schrödinger potential. You have the trace log over the Schrödinger operator. And in addition, if you have this mass term, the explicit mass, you have to have an expression. You have to have an expression for this, where this is just the mass of the fermions in the vacuum. Now, Dash and Haslacher and Neve in 1975, they knew how to express this in terms of the reflection, in terms of the phase shift and the reflection amplitude. They knew how to express this. This is nothing, but this is really the Casimir energy, because when you subtract from it the vacuum, the trace log is nothing but the sum over all modes in the presence of the soliton. Minus the, if you subtract the vacuum energy, this is really what the trace log is. So this is the Casimir effect, or the fermion one loop correction. And this, however, is more problematic because it has nothing to do with the Schrödinger potential. It has to do with the so-called superpotential, if I may use a parlance of supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So, but yours truly was able to find a representation for this integral in terms of the reflection amplitude. And in all these expressions depend on the reflection amplitude through a functional of the reflection amplitude squared, multiplied by some kernel, which is non-singular. So instead of working with the potential, the idea of inverse scattering is that to trade the potential, which is a functional degree of freedom, the value of the function everywhere. Of course, you have to assume that the function decays as the right asymptotic behavior. But for such functions, you can trade the functional data, the infinite functional data, by the information on the reflection amplitude, the phase shift, and the bound states, and the location of the bound states. Okay? So you can express all these integrals in terms of this data. So instead of varying with respect to sigma, I will now vary with respect to the reflection amplitude and with respect to the location of the bound states. This is the inverse scattering analysis. And what you find is that in terms of the reflection amplitude, all dependencies in this form. So when you take the functional derivative of the functional with respect to the reflection amplitude, you get something proportional. So delta S to delta R star at K is proportional to R at K by something non-singular. The only way it can vanish is when R is zero. This means that the sigma has to be reflectionless. And therefore, you reduce the problem from finding an infinite continuum of infinite functions to the problem of finding functions parameterized by numbers, by parameters, which is once you realize that sigma has to be reflectionless, sigma depends on parameters, say the location of the bound states. So you have a function, the action becomes a function of these parameters, and then you find their minimum. Okay? And in this way, you are able to construct the solitons exactly. We don't have time to discuss this. So if you give me a system with k bound states, I can write for you the sigma. Okay? Dash and Haslacher and Evrei only analyzed the single bound state case. But actually, it's possible to write down the most general case. Therefore, you have the shape of the soliton. And in addition, you can calculate the action. You can calculate the mass. Okay. So Dash and Haslacher and Evrei calculated the case for capital M equals to zero. They found that in the case of single bound state, which contains I'm talking about the non-topological soliton. So this is the spectrum of the Dirac equation. You have two bound states, charge conjugated bound pairs. This is the continuum. This is the forbidden band. So here are the bound states. So let's assume this contains H holes, namely it has N minus H fermions, and this has P particles. So the energy of the soliton which binds this number of fermions depends only on the number of particles plus holes. Okay? It's in effect, if you take into account the fermionic degrees of freedom, it's in effect an O to N antisymmetric tensor of rank N, because it's an N fermion system. And its mass and this is its mass. Obviously a non-perturbative result. Okay? If you discuss the kink, if you discuss the topological soliton, the situation is this. You have a single bound state at zero. It's unpaired, unlike this. It's self-charge conjugate. And its mass is given by this expression. You see, all these solitons are very heavy. They go like n, and n is 1 over g squared. So it's very non-perturbative. And moreover, this kink has the peculiar property that the So this king can contain up to two n fermions. So let's say there are n fermions stuck in this bound state. If you take all possibilities, you get a multiplet, which is known as the spinor representation. It's a 2 to the n-dimensional representation, because for each flavor, either it's occupied or empty. Okay? And the fermion number is fractionalized. The expectation value of the fermion number gets shifted by half. That's a famous phenomenon of fermion number fractionalization, which occurs when you have a topologically non-trivial background. And when you have the capital mass not equals to zero, then you get a more complicated expression. Some 12 years ago, Tony Z and I were able to guess. We used the variational calculation, which later on it turned out was the exact expression. So we guessed correctly, and we didn't know that we guessed the correct wave function as a variational trial function. This could be realized only when I was able to express this in terms of the reflection amplitude and see that indeed these were also reflectionless quantities. So you see sometimes it's possible to obtain non-perturbative information on quantum field theory. You see, we started with a microscopic theory with local fermionic operators. I mean, quanta were just fermions created or annihilated by the psi fields, and we ended up with extended object. In fact, this is a toy model for expressing hadrons. The Begg model for hadrons is actually the 3 plus 1 dimensional version of this spiel, of this game. But unlike the real life case, this is exactly solvable, so you can actually calculate everything. There are lots of things to be done in this problem if you are interested. For example, as I already mentioned, the time-dependent case where Dash and Hazelcher and everyone had a sporadic guess because they were very clever, and they were able to build on their work on Sine-Gordon breeders and bring what they knew from there to here. But nobody knows what is the general structure behind it. Another thing that is interesting is to look for crystals of these kinks, of these solitons, to find periodic self-consistent solutions. Many years ago, Baruch Horowitz, now in Beersheba in Israel, was able to guess such a solution. The solution is given, sigma is given in terms of some Jacobi elliptic functions. So he used the ansatz, variational ansatz, and he found a solution. However, it would be interesting to do it constructively, I mean, from scattering data. And this should involve sexy things like integrable models on Riemann surfaces. I mean, the solutions of periodic KdV equations is related to that. So it's very, very beautiful. And this is an open problem. And very recently, my friend Gerald Dunn was able to use this resolvent method for the Nabu-Yonah-Lasinio, I mean the Karel Gross-Neve model on Nabu-Yonah-Lasinio, and he found a crystal of these kinks in one dimension. Again, he used the variational ansatz. He applied the analog of this Gelfand-Dicke equation and was able to find a solution by trial and error, and it worked. So it would be nice to obtain it from first principle as well. So thank you. Sorry for... Of course, everything is online, so all the details are online.
What is the interpretation in terms of the original fermions?
Okay, so what you have is psi bar psi makes a condensate, okay? And this condensate, if you have a soliton, is non-uniform in space. So that's why it is a model for hadron. sigma has a dip in the soliton case, in the non-topological soliton case. So asymptotically, okay. So you have a dip in the shape. Asymptotically, of course, it goes to the relaxes to the vacuum, and here you have bound states. So you can fill it with fermions. Therefore, build hadrons. I call it hadrons because the model is asymptotically free. It mimics the QCD in real life. So you obtain a construction which binds fermions into a stable entity, the soliton. In fact, it is the binding. In this non-topological case, it is the binding of fermions which gives it stability, because the more it binds, the more energy it releases as a binding energy, and it becomes more stable. It's called the mattress effect in the bag business, the fermion in fermion bag business. I mean, so just imagine more and more people on the same mattress makes a dip, and they become more involved on the mattress. Okay? And therefore more stable. And this is exactly the situation. So you can actually see from this expression, you can see that the binding energy increases, the stability increases as you increase n. Okay? So just subtract from it the mass of n, of small n fermions, and you see that it is a monotonic function of n. And so that's the interpretation from the point of view of the fermions, that they prefer to destabilize the vacuum. You have a massive object. You have a massive object. The massive object prefers. Okay, this is the way to look at it. You have a massive fermion here. Okay, it sits in the vacuum, so it can lower its energy. Why? Because it can dig a hole. Once it digs a hole, it changes the curvature of the shape of the sigma. So it pays with gradient energy. And these things can balance. And when they balance, you get the self-consistent profile. So this is the way for the system to lower its energy.
Can I just one comment, because you didn't mention the nice work of Thies and Wollich?
Sorry. Yeah. You're absolutely correct. I forgot, completely forgot. Sorry. Michel Thies in Erlangen and his co-workers, students and co-workers, they also studied the Gros-Neve models systematically in recent years. And what they did, they used the Hartree-Fock, relativistic Hartree-Fock method. So they wrote a test function, variational test function, and found the best fit, I mean the best variational wave function. And of course, they get back the results of Dash and Aslacher-Neve and my results and other people's results, but also they made important contribution to studying periodic solitons, adding to the work of Horowitz in fact they started this heroic effort of mapping the phase structure of the model, and actually they corrected, this may be of interest to you, they because you work on phase diagrams of field theories, no? They corrected the misconception of concerning the phase diagram of this model when you add temperature and chemical potential. But it's very detailed, very complicated. It's impossible to describe here. It's a pity he's not here. So, yeah, it's an important work. Thank you for mentioning, reminding me.